It's early evening in late November 1993. A pair of forensic officers, clothed head to toe in white protective suits, are hunched over a plot of earth. They are in a large, carefully manicured residential garden. Behind them, two more officers emerge from a house, holding a Perspex evidence box, which they then carry carefully to their vehicle at the end of the driveway. It's a scene from a film. Forensic officers going about their work with a silent, stealthy efficiency, drawing as little attention as they can. But it's the two officers in the garden who catch the eye of the detective overseeing proceedings. One is holding a garden fork, the other a large industrial torch. The daylight is starting to dim just enough for it to come in useful, and they're both kneeling, feeling through the upturned earth in front of them. As the detective approaches, the officers stand and turn. In his outstretched hand, one of them holds a potato. He dusts off the soil which is clinging to it, holds it up for the three of them to see, and places it in a brown evidence bag. These officers believe this humble potato might hold the key to solving a double murder and proving a case against a man who believed he had got away with his crimes. My name is Romola Gary, and I'm an actress who's always been fascinated by how criminal cases are solved, the amazing processes that go on behind the scenes, and the clues that clinch the case.
My name is Tracy Alexander. I'm the head of the British Academy of Forensic Sciences. I've spent years finessing these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice, and my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and that the wrongly convicted have gone free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun. Episode 8, The Potato.
Derek and Eileen Severs were pillars of their community in Hambleton, in the heart of Rutland, England's smallest county. Surrounded on three sides by the beautiful Rutland waters, Hambleton is a sleepy village with no more than 250 residents. Residents who are incredibly proud of their village. Predictably, everyone knows everyone, and everyone knew Derek and Eileen Severs, who'd lived in the village for over 20 years. Always friendly, always ready to lend a hand at community functions, always reliable. They were a well-respected, well-liked, aspirational couple on the peninsula. 68-year-old Derek was a successful businessman. He'd worked for years as an executive, travelling across the country and working long hours. But now, Derek was taking life a little easier. At 6 foot and 20 stone, Derek was hard to miss, and he was regularly seen around the village, meeting friends, nipping to the butcher, and generally leaning into his retirement. His wife, 69-year-old Eileen, was steadfast in her charity work, so much so that in 1990, she was awarded an MBE for her charitable endeavours and prison volunteering. The couple's work ethic had allowed them to build a good life for themselves. They lived in a beautifully designed bungalow on the peninsula, overlooking Rutland Water itself. The grounds of the house were extensive, they drove a nice car, and they took numerous holidays every year.
Derek and Eileen also had one son, Roger. But here, the Severs' picture-perfect life seemed to become a little rougher around the edges. As an only child, Roger had every privilege you could imagine growing up in a well-to-do, middle-class family. He'd been doted on his entire childhood and long into adulthood, well into his 20s. His parents had rented a flat for him and were always on hand to settle any debts his lifestyle accrued, which was sizable and accrued frequently. Roger was now 37 and didn't seem to be able to hold down a job for more than a few months at a time. Over the years, he'd been a barman, a crop sprayer, an ironmonger, and a shop assistant. Relationship-wise, too, Roger had never been able to form the kind of committed connection demonstrated by his parents' marriage. But he was trying, they supposed. In search of a girlfriend, he'd regularly browse the Lonely Heart column in the paper. But the woman who responded to his advertisements rarely got a clear picture of who he was. At various times, he told his dates that he was a successful businessman, a hospital consultant, and, at times, even a gynecologist. Every time a relationship broke down, every time Roger left employment on bad terms, he would lean on his parents for support. And they obliged. But in his early 30s, Roger met someone who would soon become his official girlfriend. His parents finally thought this was the one. This was the juncture at which their son would settle down and grow up. His girlfriend was down to earth and hardworking. She ran a hotel, and Roger started to help her with the running of it too. After a while, they also announced they were expecting a baby. And with the arrival of Derek and Eileen's first and only grandchild, everything seemed so promising. Like they had with his father, the couple absolutely doted on their grandson. But, predictably, this equilibrium couldn't be maintained for long. The relationship broke down, and Roger's girlfriend accused her other half of using the hotel's takings as his private bank, leaving her thousands of pounds in debt.
This time, Derek and Eileen had had enough. They now had a grandchild to consider. This wasn't a situation they could bail Roger out of. They didn't want to excuse his behaviour or gloss over things with money. In fact, they issued an ultimatum. Roger must make his relationship with his girlfriend work, or they would cut all ties with him. He wouldn't inherit a penny from them, and everything would go to their grandson. This was a new tack from the Severs, and Roger, used to getting his own way and having his parents help to clean up his messes, did not take it well. A series of heated arguments took place, but his parents' minds remained unchanged. Roger resorted to even more drastic measures, even faking a suicide attempt in an effort to change their minds. Still, Derek and Eileen were unmoved. They'd grown tired of their son's irresponsibility. Their priorities had shifted, and Roger was in very real danger of being cut off for good. Meanwhile, the few friends and acquaintances of Roger Severs were seeing a different side to him. They weren't aware of the money worries or the breakdown of his relationship. Severs adopted something of a Walter Mitty approach to the truth. He claimed he was successfully navigating life as a businessman, at one point a national manager for Weetabix, and on another occasion, a security boss at London's most exclusive store, Harrods. Roger Severs was, depending on who you spoke to, experiencing the highest highs or the lowest lows that life could throw at you.
On the 13th of November 1993, at 1:30 in the afternoon, Eileen Severs, immaculately turned out as usual, said her goodbyes to friends and left the charity bazaar she'd been attending. It had been a lovely morning, and a fair amount of money had been raised. She headed home. A couple of hours later, she'd be joined by her husband. He'd had a long lunch at the pub and made his way home at 3:30 to spend the afternoon with his wife. That was a typical day for the Severs, busy, bustling, keeping up with friends and generally being central to goings-on in Hambleton. The following day, Derek and Eileen's son Roger drove into the village to deliver prizes to the two people who'd been triumphant in the charity bazaar's raffle. The prize recipients remembered thinking Roger was in a bit of a hurry that day. But perhaps that wasn't so strange. He told them breathlessly that his parents were waiting for him in the car, and he was just running in as a favour to them. They couldn't dash about as quickly as him at their age, after all. A few days later, two of Eileen's friends remarked that she'd missed a lunch date with them. She'd also failed to turn up to take a friend to a hospital appointment as she'd promised. Derek, too, hadn't attended a scheduled meeting. Oversights, everyone assumed. They were a busy couple, after all. Perhaps they'd gone away for a few days. But those days turned into a week of no contact, which was completely out of character for the conscientious Severs. Nobody even answered the phone or the doorbell. And neighbours commented that the Severs' garden, large in size but always immaculate, was looking a little unkempt. The grass was overgrown, which Derek would have been dismayed with. When these friends asked Roger where his parents were, he casually remarked that they were away. They'd gone on a trip. Again, so unlike the fastidious Severs couple to go on a holiday when they had made commitments. Collectively, the Severs' friends and acquaintances knew something wasn't right. And a week after Derek and Eileen were last seen in person, on the 18th of November 1993, they went to the police and reported the Severs missing.
Leicestershire Police Force took the news of Derek and Eileen's alleged disappearance in their stride. The Severs were grown-ups, and their son wasn't worried. So initially, they supposed the friends' worries were overblown. After all, this was Hambleton. Gossip could escalate quickly. But nevertheless, the following day, an officer was dispatched and knocked on the door of the Severs' bungalow, where they were greeted by Derek and Eileen's son, Roger. They're on holiday. They'll be back next week, he calmly assured the constable, who left the bungalow satisfied that everything was in order. However, when Detective Superintendent John Kavanagh arrived on shift later that day and read the case notes, he felt it warranted another house call. It was unusual that the usually reliable Derek and Eileen had gone AWOL. He wanted to be sure nothing was amiss. On Friday, the 20th of November, Detective Superintendent Kavanagh, accompanied by a constable, knocked once again on the Severs' bungalow door. This time, they asked to have a look around the house. In his parents' absence, Roger, it seemed, had been doing a spot of DIY, some interior renovation to their home. It looked like two carpets had been removed from the house, one from the kitchen and one from the bathroom. Roger said his father's bath had overflowed and the carpet was damaged beyond repair, so he wanted to surprise them by replacing it. Apparently, accident-prone Derek had also dropped a chip pan on the kitchen carpet, and the oil stains wouldn't come out. He'd burned both carpets in the garden. Perhaps it was because of Roger's efforts at some home improvements, but the house was messy and in disarray. Something police would later discover was absolutely out of the ordinary in the fastidiously tidy Severs home. As officers looked around the house and in the garden, the lead detective chatted to Roger. Affably, the SIO inquired as to where his parents had gone on holiday. Roger couldn't remember exactly where. They're away. They'll be back next week. The officers exchanged a glance with one another. Things were adding up in all the wrong ways.
When officers arrived at the Severs' bungalow to take Roger in for questioning, he was nowhere to be seen. And Leicestershire police immediately circulated a wanted notice in the local area. telling the public that Roger was wanted by the police in connection with his parents' disappearance. At this point, two investigative tactics were deployed. Some officers followed up on the theory that Derek and Eileen may indeed have gone on holiday, and detectives were sent to King's Cross Station to scour CCTV and question station staff to see if they could find any evidence that the Severs had travelled to London, as Roger had vaguely suggested. Meanwhile, back in Rutland, officers were retracing Derek and Eileen's last known steps, which led them to realise that the charity bazaar and the pub lunch with friends were the last time either had been seen. A theory started to take shape in Detective Superintendent John Kavanagh's mind. But, as with all criminal cases, a theory needs the weight of forensics behind it. In Roger's absence, forensic officers seized control of the Severs' bungalow and began a detailed and meticulous examination. They had to sort through the unkempt mess of the house and the unusually untidy garden to try and find clues amongst the chaos. A few miles away, in a neighbouring village, police got a tip-off about Roger's whereabouts. He was happily feeding the ducks at a village pond and seemed completely surprised when police suggested he come to the station for questioning, commenting that he didn't know what all the fuss was about. Back at the bungalow, the forensic team were in full swing, and on a walk around the garden, investigators noticed something strange. While the November frost was glistening in the morning light across the Severs' grounds, on the vegetable patch, the frost had formed in patches, suggesting the earth had recently been turned over. Officers set to work examining the site more closely. Maybe something was buried there. In the bathroom, in addition to the missing carpet, some small pinprick-sized brown stains were dotted along the lower walls, on the toilet cistern, and around the rim of the toilet. Tiny teardrop marks, which scene of crime officers knew instinctively were blood. They also knew that those marks could inform everyone of what had happened. And the case was officially raised from a missing persons inquiry into an official murder investigation.
Forensic investigators sprayed a substance called luminol around the bathroom. Through a process called chemical luminescence, the luminol grows an eerie blue when it forces hemoglobin to release oxygen molecules. Luminol is powerful enough to detect hemoglobin even when the killer thinks it's been washed away. And if the person cleaning the Severs' bathroom had wanted to conceal a crime, they hadn't done a very good job. The room positively glowed with blood. Directly outside the bathroom was the Severs' hallway, which was carpeted, and a fingertip search revealed a trail of yellow fibres leading from the bathroom and along the hall. These fibres had a rolled appearance, as if they'd been made by something heavy being dragged over the carpet and balling up the fibrous threads into cylinders. It wasn't clear, though, where the fibres had come from. All the officers could tell at this stage was that it was something yellow. Forensic officers then began examining the kitchen and found an incredible clue hiding in plain sight. No forensic technique necessary. On the kitchen countertop, the lead officer saw what seemed to be a hastily scrawled to-do list. At first glance, he wondered whether it had been written by Derek or Eileen. Maybe it said something which alluded to their movements or whereabouts. But on closer inspection, he changed his mind. It looked like a list of tasks. Tasks like get Dad's car cleaned and clean bathroom. It looked like a list that someone might write if they wanted to dispose of evidence. If they wanted to cover up a murder.
While Roger was being questioned at Hambleton Police Station, the forensic search continued. Another room of interest was the server's large garage, set just apart from the bungalow. Blood tests came up negative, but there was a large damp patch on the floor which smelt of bleach, which forensic investigators wanted to pay further attention to. All signs pointed to the fact that something terrible had happened to Eileen and Derek, and that Roger was at the heart of it. But every piece of evidence they put to Roger, the list, the blood, the fibres, he batted them away as if they were nothing to worry about. "People write lists," he said casually. The police needed to find the location of Derek and Eileen to cement their theory that Roger had killed his parents. But so far, none of the evidence pointed to a location. Until, that is, investigators began to examine the Sever's car. Inside was a goldmine of evidence. There were the same yellow fibres from the hallway in the boot, and there were a couple of minute bloodstains on the seats and dashboard. The car was also incredibly muddy, inside and out, with soil caked in the wheel arches, and this was entirely out of keeping with Mr. Sever's fastidious nature. Derek kept the car immaculate. Everything suggested that the car had been driven somewhere, probably off-road, and with this, the police solidified their theory. They believed that Roger had killed his mother in the bathroom soon after she returned from the charity bazaar. When his father came home from the pub, there was an altercation in the kitchen, and Roger killed him too. The car had been used to transport their bodies to a burial site. With the evidence they had, both physical and circumstantial, on the 23rd of November 1993, D.S. Kavanagh charged Roger Severs with the murder of both of his parents. Now police just needed to establish where he'd buried them.
A search task force were immediately dispatched. And despite the freezing winter temperatures, members of the local community and wider county joined in the search too, combing the local area for any kind of clue. Police divers were sent into Rutland Water, and cameras and sonar were also used to search the depths. But no bodies were discovered. Meanwhile, samples of mud and dirt were taken from the wheel arches, mudflaps and footwells of Derek and Eileen's car, so experts could examine the stratigraphy within them. This means that the sample captured multiple layers, multiple strata of matter and material, which could then be examined individually for clues, but also as a collective. It could illuminate an entire journey just through matter collected by the vehicle en route. The mud, which was examined at Leicester University, revealed plenty of secrets. It had been accumulated recently, off-road. The soil was shown to contain quartz, calcite, ironstone, chert, and coated roadstone. And the organic matter in the sample showed 24 varieties of plant life, such as grasses, oak, ash, and lime. These are plants and trees you'd expect to find together in a wood. But 2% of the sample also included some relatively unusual species for the area, such as horse chestnut. Naturalists were able to narrow down the origins of the mud to two areas of woodland, one on and the other adjacent to the Hambleton Peninsula. Then the presence of a little piece of fishing line within the muddy mess of the car allowed them to be even more specific. The bodies were likely to be located close to the water's edge. Finally, with the help of groundbreaking forensic botany, investigators had some specific sites to search.
It was the 1st of December 1993, in the early hours of the morning, around 9:15 a.m. 2 weeks after the Severs had been reported missing. It was cold, but despite the fact they could see their own breath misting against the woodland air, search officers were determined. As police searched Armley Wood on Hambleton Peninsula, surrounded by oaks and horse chestnut trees, an officer noticed some broken twigs and branches. Nearby, there was a pile of disturbed soil, different in colour from the surrounding forest floor. The officer poked his hand into the mound. His fingers closed around cold human skin. The mound was carefully excavated using archaeological techniques and buried in the shallow grave under some loose soil. Police made the grim discovery of the bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Severs. But along with the bodies of Derek and Eileen was another, frankly, bizarre discovery. There was also a potato in and amongst the soil concealing the bodies. While horse chestnuts in the forest are rare, rogue potatoes in the midst of a crime scene are unheard of. So the forensic team knew this was a pivotal piece of evidence and set to work forensically exploring what it could tell them about the Severs' murder. Well, what they quickly discovered was that the potatoes had been growing in the soil which had been recently turned over in the garden of the Severs. It appeared, by analysing the potato, that some soil from the Severs' garden had been used to conceal their bodies here in the woods. And that pointed to one thing only.
The potato allowed Detective Superintendent Kavanagh to piece together what had happened after Roger attacked his parents in their bungalow. Roger had driven his car to Armley Woods and dragged their bodies into the undergrowth. Roger's father, Derek, was a big, heavy-set man, and Detective Superintendent Kavanagh believed it would have taken considerable effort to move his body. The shallow gravesite, just a few feet into the woods, would have been the first opportune place to leave the bodies, but this meant leaving them partially exposed. Investigators had always believed that the strata of dirt which had built up in the wheel arch of Derek Severs' car had been the result of numerous trips through muddy terrain, and now they knew why. After finding a burial site for his parents, Roger had returned to their bungalow to gather more soil. Soil from their much-loved vegetable patch, which forensic officers had noted looked different in the morning frost some weeks before. Roger filled bags with earth and made several journeys back and forth to shift 2.5 tons of soil and debris between the house to the woods. He piled the soil on top of the bodies and then disguised this disturbance with nearby leaves and twigs. But what he didn't realise was that the crime scene and burial site would be unequivocally linked by something as innocuous as a homegrown potato.
Eileen Severs had been struck at least 8 times with some kind of hammer, which had fractured her skull. Post-mortem pathologists estimated it would have taken around 30 minutes to die. Derek Severs had been struck at least 10 times with the same hammer, later presumed to be a steak mallet. The case, evidentially, was complete. But what forensic evidence couldn't confirm was why Roger did this to his parents. In custody, confronted with the overwhelming evidence, Roger Severs offered little. A theory began to emerge of Severs being enraged at not being given money. He'd become angry, lashed out and attacked his mother, and then presumably committed the same crimes against his father to try and cover his tracks. But Severs denied the crimes. A year after the event, in November 1994, the case proceeded to trial at Nottingham Crown Court. Alongside the mountains of other forensic and circumstantial evidence, an expert testified about the smoking gun, the potato, explaining to a jury how it linked the burial site to Roger and provided the proof that he had carried out their death and their burial. Faced with the facts, Roger Severs changed his plea, admitting that he had carried out the killing, but claiming diminished responsibility, that he wasn't wholly culpable for the crimes. But the trial for murder continued. Prosecutors didn't accept that Severs had any mental impairment at the time of the attacks, and a jury believed them. On the 6th of December 1994, Roger Severs was found guilty of the murder of his parents. He was convicted and given 2 life sentences, and he remains in prison to this day. Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Romola Gary.
And me, Tracy Alexander.
And supported by the British Academy of Forensic Sciences. Their work supports the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas, and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review, and help spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week, wherever you get your podcasts.